dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber. Welcome to John Barber's World. It's 5 p.m. here on December 12th in Las Vegas, Nevada, and we're live. You heard that incomparable voice. That was Sarita singing Sunny, which every day sounds like a Christmas carol to me. And that was also the incomparable Frank Sinatra the night he took over The Tonight Show from Johnny Carson, who always refused to have me on the show. And as soon as Francis got the show, the first person he booked was yours truly. And that monologue that I did on the show, you can go to johnbarbersworld.com, the YouTube, click it on, and you'll see that monologue. The opening of this show will be rather casual and unstructured. Ordinarily, I like to plan out exactly what I'm going to say at the top of the show because time and words are precious. But not in this case. As you can tell, I have a little bit of a cold. For 25 years, I have always bragged that I never get a cold. I never take a flu shot. It's not that I'm a health. I just eat ordinary foods, fruits and vegetables, a lot of fish, drink a glass of wine every day. Never get a cold, but I got a cold when I went to Dallas 2 weeks ago to screen the second part two of the Garrison tapes, the American media and the second assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And while I was there, my wife said, well, you were exposed to somebody sick. How could you be exposed to somebody sick? Well, the truth was I was exposed to somebody sick, but they weren't physically sick. They were emotionally sick. And I must tell you, there are some people who are contagious carriers of stress. And I have been infected with that stress for the last couple of weeks. But fortunately, it is gone. I am better. And as a matter of fact, the film is better. I would like to, at the top, thank Gary Fannin, Beverly Oliver Messagey, and Jim Mars, because on the November 21st, which was a Monday at 1 p.m., they made sure there were over 200 people present to see the almost finished version of this film. The end of the movie was met with such a spontaneous standing ovation. I, who had promised that I would do a Q&A afterwards, was emotionally ill-equipped to do that Q&A. I was so moved, I just couldn't talk, and so I had to leave the theater. Since we have come back, we have not only finished the credits, which we were unable to put on the screen at the time. We thank not only everyone involved with the film, but the 57 individuals from around the world who sent in money to help us make this film. I appreciate that as much as I appreciate anything that anybody contributed to this movie. And then when we got back, we had Joe Satilli, who will be on here shortly, who's the associate producer. Our consigliere, Brian Lloyd, who supplied some of the greatest research to this, and Gary Fannin, and also, they got copies of the film, sent me a couple of factual corrections, which we have made, and just before I went on the air tonight, the closest and dearest person to me, I must say, in the involvement of this movie, is Gino Minari, who owns the copyright to the name Houdini. He is a magician. He's a magician in many ways. As a matter of fact, he is the world's largest seller of magic tricks, and he appeared out of nowhere like a rabbit out of a hat to save this film. This film would not have been ready for Dallas at the time. It wouldn't have been ready tonight. Just before going on the air, he said, John, it's a fait accompli. It's a rap party. So I'm telling you, after the first of the year, first of all, a couple of things. because of the success of that screening, if you go to our group page, which is the American Media and the Second Assassination, President John F. Kennedy, you'll see scores of unsolicited rave reviews. I mean, reviews that I would not even write myself. I am telling you that after the first of the year, when we decide how we're going to distribute this, and I'll say this quickly, the first film, The Garrison Tapes 1, my partner sold in 1992 to Cinemax before we could get a theatrical release. And members of the Academy, who were friends of mine, said, John, he just blew an Academy Award for you. Well, I'm not going to make that mistake with this film, because Jim Garrison's story deserves that kind of attention. It's not that I need an Oscar or want an Oscar. I want Jim's story to get the widest possible audience. So in January, that's what we're shooting for. And once we decided that, whether it happens or it doesn't happen, it will be available to the widest possible audience. I assure you, you will have a hard time. You know, I have asked a number of people in the film industry, what's the most important movie ever made in America? And nobody could answer it. They would say, well, Gone with the Wind made a lot of money. The Godfather is a great movie, but not an important film, just a great film. Probably the most important film would probably be JFK by Oliver Stone. That got the Records Act passed by Congress in 1992, and some of those documents are moved and are revealed in this movie. However, I'm going to tell you quite honestly, if I said to you the second word in the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, the American media, if I said this is probably the most important film ever made in America, you would be very hard-pressed to challenge that. Come close second might obviously be Oliver Stone's film. So it's going to be well worth the wait. Now, a lot of people have become suddenly interested in part one. Ask me where they can get the VHS. Do not bother with the VHS. Go to Amazon, search the last word on the assassination. You will not only get the Garrison tapes, you'll get a three-minute story, new material, which is not even in part two, about how Jim Garrison tracked down Lawrence B. Myers as the fellow who gave Jack Ruby the orders to shoot Lee Harvey Oswald. All of this is followed by the best panel you will ever gather anywhere. It's Joan Mellon, Dick Russell, and Jim Mars. It only costs $2 or $3 to download. You feel free to videotape it, or you can buy a great-looking set for $14 or $15. So that being said, quickly to a little, if you're also up there, now this is a little disappointing to me. First of all, the last word on the assassination sells one or two copies every single day with no publicity. It is all word of mouth, which is what is more than going to happen with part two of the Garrison tapes. But up there also is a book. It's my book. It's called John Barber's Facebook Book, Uncensored, Volume 1. It is 65 pages of some really funny, witty, bright, controversial, interesting stuff. And it doesn't sell two or three a month. Now, that shocks me, because it is really good, if I do say so myself, but I do not write for money. I write for the pleasure of just saying it. And if that's payment enough for me. If it brings a smile to somebody, they don't have to part with their money. Anyway, a fan, here's a Christmas gift to me, wants this book signed by me. So I have it in front of me. Let me tell you, you can open it any page and find something worthwhile. At least I think it. I just opened it up at page 58 and 59. Okay, listen to this. A 57-year-old veteran won $1 million in the Michigan lottery. And when asked if it would change his life, he said it would not. He would remain unemployed. I went to Home Depot the other day and bought a keg of nails. When I opened it, I found a can of soup. While I was there, a blonde stopped at the lumberyard and told the worker her husband sent her to pick up a dozen 2x4s. The clerk asked her how long she'd like them, and she said, "A long time, we're building a garage." And then I have three definitions which I love. Okay, it's just me. One is junk mail. Junk mail, M-A-L-E. Slang for a transsexual. U.S. foreign policy. has gone from Uncle Sam to Son of Sam. And I love this one since it's the Christmas season. An acorn, a commercial for God. Okay, now I'm not going to be talking to any of you till Monday after the day of Christmas. So this is my little time up for a little bah humbug, okay? This is just me. I don't care if it's not you. It is me, and this is how I feel. And I'm glad. I'll be glad when I'm finished so I can introduce my guest, who's a whole lot more interesting than I am. Anyway, here it is, a time out for bah humbug. A lot of folks on Facebook are calling for a temporary cessation of negativity and name-calling this time of year so Americans can celebrate the holiday. Well, what exactly is this holiday we're celebrating? We're celebrating the appearance of an overweight, unshaven fellow with a W.C. Fields complexion, an ill-fitting red suit who only works once a year. That day is December 25th. The fake birthday of a long-dead, short-lived, unemployed carpenter and part-time preacher whose real name was Joshua Ben Joseph. On this day, this candidate for NBC's The Biggest Loser is supposed to be carrying a sack of never-ending toys purchased probably on credit by financially strapped parents for kids who may or may not deserve them. Then, we are to believe this bulbous bearer of gifts delivers these toys down a chimney when he himself couldn't be squeezed into a smokestack. That this trip of 15,000 miles across the entire Western Hemisphere takes place in just one night. And that the mode of speed of light transportation is a sled pulled by 8 gravity-defying flying reindeer, and that all of this is accomplished without one of these 8 reindeer dropping his lunch on a house. If you believe this, you believe there is peace on earth. Anyway, that's it. It's also up there. Get it if you feel like having a chuckle. Anyway, when I was in Dallas, my consigliere, which is Italian for lawyer, if you saw The Godfather, and that's going to be his credit in the documentary, his name is Brian Lloyd, contributed vast amounts of great media material. Anyway, he kept calling me and saying, hey, the first person I want to meet when I get down there is not Cyril Weck. It's this journalist. It's this investigative reporter who used to live here in Washington. Well, I had the fortune to meet this fellow long before our consigliere did. I must tell you, it was the most interesting conversation I had, and that includes also Dr. Cyril Weck, with whom I spent a wonderful half hour, and Beverly Oliver Messagey, with whom I spent an afternoon watching the film. He is one of these people who has a knack and a nose for a story that does not exist in American journalism anymore. He has this fabulous periodical called the Wayne Madsen Report. Years ago, he was the first to expose the fact that Barack Obama was a member of a gay bathhouse. He exposed, long before anybody took it on, that there were some deep, serious questions about 9/11. The only other person I heard who said that was Hunter Thompson. The day after it happened, he was on an Australian radio program saying it was an inside job. Anyway, he is fabulous. His report is fabulous, and he is with us right now. He has read all around the world. He's listened to all around the world. And now he's here on John Barber's World, Wayne Madsen. Wayne, thank you so much for being here. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Good to be with you this evening.
Well, not only fascinated just talking to you and listening to your stories, but when I got home, I, of course, went to Wikipedia, as I always do, looking for your background story. It is so interesting. Tell us a little bit about your background and your parents and where they came from.
Well, I actually have had a long-standing feud with Wikipedia. Never wanted that entry. There's a lot of misinformation in there. But, you know, they do what they need to do. And I've already outed them obviously it's a CIA disinformation operation.
Could I tell you something quite quickly? You know what is astonishing? And it's in the film. It's at the top of the film. that if you Google the Warren Report on Wikipedia, you know that how they refer to November 22nd, the brutal public assassination of John Kennedy?
God only knows.
They call it an infraction in Dallas.
Well, I think that's the Wikipedia I've come to know and despise. I was a naval officer. Assigned at one point in time to the National Security Agency back in the 80s. I was also an NSA contractor. And I got very much involved then in the privacy advocacy. Having worked at NSA, you realize how precarious our privacy rights are. And I've been doing full-time investigative journalism since the early 90s.
Do you have siblings, brothers and sisters?
I do. I've got four. I had two brothers and two sisters. One brother is deceased. My father he had an interesting background. He fought against Franco's forces during the Spanish Civil War, basically providing weapons. He was in the Danish Merchant Marine. He was from Copenhagen and sailed a lot of weapons down to the Loyalist side and installed some radio stations up in the Pyrenees so they could communicate from Spain across the mountains into France because there was a support network in France. My grandmother, who I never met in Denmark, she fought in the underground. Was very instrumental in rescuing and getting into Sweden on fishing boats about 7,000 Danish Jews, but also any other refugees, including many Jews who arrived in Denmark from other parts of Europe. So,
Wayne, there's a fabulous story in Ben Heck's autobiography called The Child of the Century about the fate of the Danish Jews when the Germans took over Denmark. They ordered that every Jew wear this yellow cross.
Right.
And the next day, the King of Sweden had every citizen of Denmark wear a yellow cross.
Including himself.
That's right. Is that one? That is a whole lot better than Schindler's List, I'll tell you that.
Right.
Go ahead.
Well, the only other thing is my grandmother, having, you know, being in the resistance, she was also a journalist and a novelist, and she was also a member of the Danish Communist Party, which was kind of interesting that I later, you know, who I never met her, but, you know, she probably would have laughed if she had known I was working at the National Security Agency for
that is
for
really. Time. Yeah. It's a wonder with that background they let you join.
Well, they never asked, and I never brought it up.
Were you the only one in your family who sort of had inherited this radical rebel gene?
No, my father, as I said, assisted the loyalists in Spain, during the whole war. He was with the Merchant Marine under various flags because his country had been occupied by the Nazis. At one point in time, I think he was flying under the Panamanian flag and carrying a Panamanian passport. Eventually wound up with the U.S. Merchant Marine. But
what prompted? Were you like Snowden? Were you like an early Snowden who decided, no. Wow, this is not for me? And what?
No,
go ahead.
I left NSA. I got out of the Navy, and I left NSA. I was there as a lieutenant in the Navy, and I worked as a contractor. It wasn't until after I was kind of free and clear of NSA, several years between my time there and what I was doing, that I got involved with the privacy community and worked on advocacy, and the organizations I was with, we were at loggerheads with NSA on many issues. I'm not in favor of getting rid of our ability to, you know, do signals intelligence work. Every country has that capability. I'm more concerned about the fact, and we're, you know, heard many people talk about their research into the JFK assassination in Dallas. I'm very concerned now with the obvious and blatant attempt by the CIA to deny Donald Trump the presidency. It's really overt. It's, you know, trying to influence the Electoral College. It's sort of like this war that's broken out between Trump and the CIA is very similar to the last time we saw that kind of war break out between a president and the CIA. And that was John F. Kennedy, who sure. said, I'm going to take this agency, tear it into 1,000 pieces and cast it into the wind, or something to that effect.
That's right.
I'm actually, you know, one has different opinions on Trump, but on this showdown with the CIA, I certainly support him. Jimmy Carter tried, got rid of the Bush cronies there, but they eased him out with creating this Iran hostage situation, which was
exactly.
great. Got rid of him, the October surprise, all that business. Truman regretted that he ever, signed the legislation that created him. Eisenhower tried to warn us about the danger of that complex, which he, of course, was including the CIA in that.
Eisenhower was a general. He was an extremely popular president, an extremely popular general. He could have taken some steps. He could have taken the steps to step into the military-industrial complex. Instead, he stepped out of office and he left it to a young 43-year-old young man to deal with, which was really rather cruel because we saw what happened to John Kennedy. What was the first time you decided to write an independent story and it created some waves and you saw that you were on the right path for the track of your life?
Oh, let's see. Well, it probably was back in the 90s when I first started into this investigator reporting. One of the first stories I looked at was the Vince Foster death. Now, I'm not saying anything about whether it was suicide or homicide. I do know one thing after the investigation. Wherever he was killed or died or committed suicide, it wasn't at Fort Marcy Park.
Right.
I spent a lot of time there. I talked to so many people involved with the investigation. That body had been transported to that park and dumped there because wherever it happened, I tend to believe if he committed suicide, it was in his vehicle.
Hello?
About that conflicting Skype call here. I think it may have been in his vehicle parked at the White House parking lot. And they didn't want that kind of scandal on their hands. So they moved the body, which was a crime, by the way.
When you reported that story or that observation, what kind of feedback and reaction did you get?
Well, it was, it's negative all the time. If you don't run with the pack, then you're criticized. And journalists in Washington run in packs. They sing from the same song sheet usually. The reaction was rather negative. We were told, it was suicide at the park, even though there was clear evidence that the investigation was mishandled, that the U.S. Park Police have jurisdiction for Fort Marcy Park, they're probably one of the more incompetent law enforcement agencies in the D.C. area. And I think that's why he wound up in the park. They knew exactly what they were doing. Fairfax County, which was even then the number one county for high tech, the X-ray machine. There was no working X-ray machine in Fairfax County for the coroner to do x-rays of the body.
When you found out that you weren't part of the pack, what was your feeling when you began to look into revealing Barack Obama's membership in a gay club?
Well, yeah, I mean, I first heard about this at the National Press Club at a news conference by a guy named Larry Sinclair, who claimed that he had had two gay episodes with Obama when he was a state senator. I was one of the two reporters that really hit him very hard on that and said, look, you have no proof. This is all hearsay. Why should we believe you? You have no documents. On any of this. Later he said it was me and Ben Smith from Politico who really were the roughest on him. And then later, when I decided to go out and conduct an investigation of Rod Blagojevich's rather hasty departure from politics in Illinois, that story didn't sound right to me. They were piling on the guy. Look, he wasn't a great sympathetic figure, but we're talking about a governor of Illinois, and he said he had information. He wasn't going to part with that Senate seat unless he got something in return. And I knew Chicago politics. I know it. It's hardball. I went out there, and the first thing I started hearing was about Barack Obama, Rahm Emanuel, and this gay network of politicians in the Chicago area. And that's where I said, wait a minute, I've heard all this stuff before. I heard from this guy Sinclair. So I called Sinclair from Chicago, and he says, oh my God, why are you calling me? You're one of my worst detractors on my story. I said, well, that was then. Based on what I'm hearing in Chicago, I want to revisit the story. So I conducted a lot of interviews out there, and it is quite clear that the Man's Country Bathhouse, which is billed as the grand old bathhouse of Chicago, north of what they call Boys Town. I think the address, it was at Clark and Diversity Streets. Sure enough, I talked to members of the gay community. They were quite familiar with Barack Obama when he was a member there.
Well, you know, that is a story that just won't die. And the other story that won't die, and it keeps popping up on the internet, is Joan Rivers one day is going up the stairs into a club or apartment or home or something, and somebody's asking about, you think we'll ever have a gay president? And she says, we got one, and we got a transsexual first lady. And then a couple of months later, she's dead, and there's something floating around the internet now about this mysterious doctor who showed up to perform some kind of operation on her vocal cords. And she couldn't breathe, and she died, and then this guy disappeared. How much credence do you give Joan's story about Obama and Michelle, and how much credence do you give the thought that perhaps there was some foul play in her death?
Well, I didn't look at anything having to do with Michelle Obama. But what I did look at her, you know, she had to give up her law license, and the agreement that she struck with the Illinois bar, that whatever was in that agreement, we can't read it because it's under lock and key at the Illinois Supreme Court in Springfield. I wanted to find out, well, why can't the first lady practice law anymore? And not that she would if she was first lady, but she may want to return to the legal practice. But whatever it was something that she made a deal out of court. She was in a lot of trouble, and all I was told, whatever it was, it had something to do with Valerie Jarrett's business, and this is Obama's domestic policy advisor, and that she may have affixed her signature on a fraudulent document. So, but we'll never know because it's up to the Illinois Supreme Court to release that, and I don't think they ever will. What Joan Rivers had to say, I really don't know anything about that. I'm just not in any position. Now, as far as her death is concerned, it sounded like it was gross malpractice.
I believe, what was it, a plastic surgeon or something?
Yes, and it's the simplest of procedures, so it does seem bizarre. Now,
well, you know, I do remember simple procedures sometimes can, result in these more complicated issues. John Murtha, who was the congressman from Pennsylvania, Democrat, he was the chairman of the House Appropriations Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense Appropriations, very powerful position. He went in for routine gallbladder surgery at Bethesda Naval Hospital. And, you know, this guy who was in the Marine Corps, you know, he's a tough guy, big guy. It turned septic and he went to the hospital in Arlington, Virginia, and he died. And I couldn't believe that was...
Wayne, 80,000 Americans are killed in hospitals every year from malpractice. And you remember a comedian named Toadie Fields? She went in for a facelift and she died on the table getting a facelift. Now, the stories and stuff that you started to write about 911, I believe, were first published in England, weren't they?
Oh, well, you're not going to get any story on 911 on anything mainstream. They went to websites around the world. I had spent many, many weeks in New Jersey and New York, looking at a lot of facets about 9/11, everything from the so-called dancing Israelis, the five guys that were arrested right next to Giant Stadium that afternoon, to some financial transactions that were very, very bizarre that were picked up by J.P. Morgan's risk analysis team before 9/11. So I spent a long time up there. It was my conclusion, of course, that this was known about in advance. The only question is, did the Bush administration let it happen on purpose, or were they absolutely involved in making it happen on purpose? And having worked in the Navy on contingency and continuity of government operations during the Reagan administration, when, you know, we were facing a potential nuclear war, I came to the conclusion, no, we had safeguards in place to prevent this type of thing in the 80s, and how this could have happened in 2001, I came to the conclusion that it had to have involved senior people in the Defense Department, intelligence community, and the White House.
This brings us back again to Donald Trump, because a couple of times during the campaign, you will remember, he referenced 911. And a lot of folks got, really interested. Hey, maybe when he gets in, he might look into 911. Now fast forward again to the business of Donald Trump versus the CIA. I read a lot, as you could well imagine, so I know what it is half the time that I'm talking about. I do not see many references anywhere to Donald Trump's problems with the CIA. They somehow, in the media, seem to be subliminal, but when I listen to you, it looks like they're really above board.
Yeah, you know, and look, it was also Trump that highlighted a story that I first came out with about Rafael Cruz taking his father and Oswald in New Orleans. So clearly he's been irritating the hell out of the CIA. And one can have their opinions on, I'm not happy with some of the people he's picking for cabinet positions and whatnot, but it takes a lot of guts to go up against the Central Intelligence Agency. And I would hope that one of the first things he does, because it's now, there's a guy, a congressman named Jim Himes from Connecticut 4th Congressional District. Connecticut has always had at least one CIA plant in their House of Representatives delegation.
Yes.
This guy Himes represents the 4th, and that's Stamford, Greenwich, New Canaan. This is CIA heavy. Most of them work on Wall Street. And Himes is now saying the Electoral College should block Trump because he's unhinged. I looked at Himes' background, and it's his father was with the Ford Foundation. he grew up in Lima and Quito, Ecuador, Lima, Peru. It's clear that this guy Himes, who worked for Goldman Sachs, is some sort of a CIA operative. Just like the guy from the Connecticut Second, this guy Rob Simmons, he was quite open about the fact he worked for the CIA. And we know that Prescott Bush was the senator. H.W.'s father was senator from Connecticut. He had all kinds of links with the CIA, as did, of course, his son, who was his director.
Well, as is pointed out in the film, there are a lot of people like David Atlee Phillips who know that the USA is no longer the USA. It's the CIA as a result of four shots fired on November 22nd, 1963 in Dallas. Wayne, I want to thank you so much for being here. Where can people go to read your report, get your books, or whatever? Tell us.
Oh, it's WayneMadsenReport.com. That's Wayne, WayneMadsen, report.com. And my latest book is called The Almost Classified Guide to CIA Front Companies, Proprietaries, and Contractors. And Wikipedia is listed therein as a CIA partner.
Oh, that's wonderful. Repeat that one more time. I love the title of the book. It must be a very thick book.
It's 366 pages. I was shocked how endemic the CIA has been all through U.S. society. It's called The Almost Classified Guide to CIA Front Companies, Proprietaries, and Contractors.
It goes
from Air America to Zapata Marine Offshore Company.
Right. Okay. It's WayneMadsenReport.com.
That's right.
Okay, Wayne, thank you so much. You have an absolutely wonderful holiday, and I hope to have you back again after the first of the year.
Same to you, John, and enjoyed being on the show this evening.
Thank you so much. Talk to you later. We'll be right back with Joe Satilli.
Great music from all the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing?
Then, great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs, conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. Go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on VBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds, with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, a tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great VBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Welcome back. This is John Barber. This is John Barber's World Live from Las Vegas, Nevada. We started at 5 p.m. with the wonderful, wonderful Wayne Madsen, a terrific investigative journalist. Now we have the author of the greatest newsletter. It's called News Vandal. And as you know, I could not do this show without him. And I wouldn't do this show without him. Joe Satilli. Joe, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm exhausted by the news cycle. I mean, it's not stopping. It's relentless. And it is fascinating. This is probably the most interesting time to be a journalist in my lifetime. Maybe the only other interesting times in my lifetime would have been Iran-Contra. A lot of fascinating stuff going on during Iran-Contra. You know, 9/11, I actually kind of covered 9/11. I was in D.C. when 9/11 happened. I saw the cloud, the little mushroom cloud come off of the Pentagon when I was driving to work. And the next day I was at Lower Manhattan smelling that smell. But that was in a sense, a containable story.
The interesting thing, it was contained. You talked about Iran-Contra. At the time of Iran-Contra, there were both sides of that story, how the Reagan team was sabotaging Jimmy Carter, which was probably true. And that's when Bush said, if they knew what we were doing, they'd track us down the street and hang us. So you saw both sides of a story. You never saw another side of 9/11. It was, as you said, contained.
Yes, yes. This right now, I mean, this election has been odd all the way through, as one would expect with Donald Trump in it. And then also, I mean, basically you had the two least liked and least trusted candidates in the history of modern politics. And when I say modern politics, that's contemporary polling. But I am really amazed at the way the stories have gone after the election. And what I'm really fascinated by are the emerging geopolitical implications of Trump's nascent presidency, particularly what he's doing with China, and how the Russian hacking story intersects with what he's doing with China, may or may not intersect, and whether or not I have this funny little theory or thesis, and it's just mostly for fun, because I do think that Vladimir Putin is playing checkers, and I think that is playing chess, and Donald Trump plays checkers. Putin is not only is he Russian, and Russians play chess, but Putin comes out of the Cold War, he comes out of the KGB, and he comes out of Russian history. And if you know anything about Russian history, the Russians know a lot about their own history. And they have a very melancholy melodramatic, not as a slight, but as really with great admiration, a melodramatic sense of their own place in Western history. Because, you know, Russia has been the buffer, at least throughout Russian history, they've thought this, many have thought this, a buffer between Western civilization and the Mongol hordes, for example, and the East, and that Russia has had to suffer in ways to preserve the West that the West has never appreciated. And
You know what? Russia always struck me, even from a kid, as a country that was created by William Shakespeare.
Well, right. Right. Well, and think about the what comes after World War II. Here is Russia losing upwards of 20 million human beings. And really, if you want to look at the fall of Nazi Germany, it has far more to do with Russia than it does with D-Day or with anything West did.
Stalingrad
in particular, but also Leningrad, but also the fact that the Russians, the Germans, when they got outside of Moscow, the Russians had held back their elite Siberian troops, and here are the Germans bogged down in a brutal, brutal Russian winter because for some reason Adolf Hitler never studied Napoleon and made the same mistake Napoleon did. And just as they are on the outskirts of Moscow, here come these Siberian elite troops in white uniforms on skis, marksmen, and started decimating the Russian blitzkrieg. So, and that's the beginning of the end. The German blitzkrieg. That's the beginning of the end of Nazi Germany. So, the West immediately, of course, drops the Iron Curtain because what's more profitable than the Cold War? Nothing. So,
right.
That happens, and I think the Russians have long felt like their contributions have been understandably unappreciated. Also add to that the fact that after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the United States, instead of doing something like a Marshall Plan, whereby the United States says, hey, you know, the war is over, you are our enemy, but now let's be a friend and let's invest in your country because it's not only good for your country, but it's also good for our country because the money that we give you will probably be spent on our corporations, which is one of the reasons why the United States got rich after World War II by putting money into Germany and Japan. A lot of that money cycled back to the United States. What they did is they danced on the grave of the Soviet Union, and Bill Clinton sent over the Harvard boys, Jeffrey Sachs, who has repented in many ways for what he did to Russia in the 90s. They gave them shock therapy, economic therapy, and took a once great world power, one of the two great world powers, and turned it into essentially a borderline third world nation. And Bill Clinton shepherded Boris Yeltsin, a drunken buffoon, through the 90s. And who was there watching all of this happen? Vladimir Putin.
That's right.
Vladimir Putin. So what I find fascinating is that this obvious affinity that Trump has for Putin, which is understandable, particularly for Putin. I mean, it makes all the sense in the world for Putin. It's the most rational thing in the world to prefer Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton, particularly not only given the Clinton administration in the 90s, but also the fact that Hillary Clinton has had the advice of the Kagan family, and particularly Robert Kagan's wife, Victoria Nuland, who was the Undersecretary of State for Eurasian Affairs and was basically organizing coups and politics inside Ukraine. There's also the no-fly zone in Syria, which is a non-starter for Russia. All of these things, why would Putin not prefer Donald Trump? Well, Trump, because he plays checkers and not chess, he's a transactional guy. And all that Putin has to do is say, oh, well, I think Donald Trump is a brilliant man. He's very, very smart. He's very, very – all he is, he's handsome. He's smart. He's rich. He's a wonderful guy. We love him. Donald Trump says, great, great. That's great. You want to be on my show? And so you make this – he has this transactional checkers analysis where all Trump's trying to do is get his checker piece to the other side of the board so he can be kinged, right? But what is interesting is that at the same time, Trump, who is really part of this anti-China push that has been lingering latent inside the Republican Party, the paleocons and the Heritage Foundation have always had China in their sights. This goes all the way back to Who Lost China and Alger Hiss and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, what's interesting is now that China and Trump is taking on China, in a sense, Putin is doing to the United States what Nixon did to the Soviet Union and China in 1972. When Nixon opened China, what he was doing was driving a wedge between the communist alliance, such as it was, so yes, that he could create separate deals. Well, now what is Putin getting? Putin is watching the alliance between the United States, it's been an alliance between the United States and China, tacit alliance. That's being broken apart. And guess who has been working on their own economic partnership? China and Russia. So maybe what Russia is doing is basically getting relief, potentially from sanctions, right? And potentially from all the pressure in Eastern Europe and NATO expansion. And at the same time, driving a wedge between the necessary economic alliance between China and the United States, and thus creating an opportunity to create a multipolar world in which China and Russia can outweigh the United States.
Now, do you think that the Central Intelligence Agency sees that and is acting on behalf of America's corporations to maintain sovereignty over the world? Do you think that is what Wayne was talking about when he's talking about the growing friction between the CIA and this guy in Connecticut trying to prevent the Electoral College from endorsing?
I think it is a possibility. I think one thing we have to remember about where the CIA is, this is not your dad's CIA. This is a CIA that has been repeatedly battered over the course of the last 25 years and was in many ways mortally wounded by the Bush administration. I actually believe that one of the things that the Bush administration tried to do, the George W. Bush administration, was destroy the power of the CIA and move that power to the NSA under John Poindexter. You know, the whole Total Information Awareness Network thing, which I wrote about in 2006, I was writing about what Snowden leaked years before Snowden leaked it, because it was obvious what was going on with John Poindexter, one of the Iran-Contra guys under Poppy Bush, was put in charge of this Total Information Awareness Network. And the functions of the CIA were being parceled out to the NSA and to the DIA under Don Rumsfeld. That's the Defense Intelligence Agency.
Right.
And, you know, there's this interesting thing that happened in the CIA. We kind of forget about this, but Valerie Plame, in the midst of what was going on with Iraq, came out and criticized the Bush administration. So why was the CIA agent doing that? It's because the leftover political operatives in the CIA who were loyal to Poppy Bush, who were part of the torture regime, and the neocons who were over there, were basically were in a battle inside the CIA with the careerists who were not willing to support the Iraq War. Much of what we knew about the failings of the Iraq War actually come internally from the CIA, because there was a battle in the CIA, and there was a long attempt there, I think, by the Bush administration to curtail or neuter the CIA.
That's
because
true.
They felt they could not control it.
Let me ask you a quick but silly question in America. Why is it, in a country of free enterprise, we have 6 or 7 major intelligence spy agencies,
right,
from NASA to CIA, Naval Intelligence, and we only have one federal bank?
Yeah. Why not add a little competition?
I just don't understand that.
So, well, look,
you're the smartest person I know, so I have to ask you.
Because the banking system is the ultimate monopoly. And, you know, particularly now that you're off of the gold standard, the whole banking system is really based on faith. It's not rooted in any real value. And one of the interesting things to me about the banking system, such as it is in the currency, is that now that it's not tied to any actual hard wealth, it's ultimately this idea that that government deficits matter is actually kind of a joke, because ultimately the value of the currency is a joke. The value of the currency is a political decision. It's not an economic decision. and as such, the perpetuation of that kind of fiat currency has to be under the control of the financial system, because the financial system, their wealth is in jeopardy if people realize that the money that they are using actually has no real hard value to it other than the political decisions behind it.
Wow.
I mean, you can't go and turn in your buck is your dollar bill, your, you know, greenback is not a silver certificate anymore.
No, so, it's not. No.
So ultimately, everything is just an accounting balance, an electronic accounting balance. We're not on the gold system. We're on the computer system, because everything is really just a number that can be moved from one side of the accounting balance to the other.
And as you pointed out before, these people in Wall Street, these firms, they don't manufacture or make anything. Right. They just move money around.
And that is the ultimate, to me, that's what happens when you come off of a gold system. It breeds financialization. because there's no actual hard asset value to the currency anymore. We've basically, we've psychologically not wrapped our head around it, because us as individuals, we like to think that we go out and we work, we get paid for our work, there's a hard value to the assets we acquire with our work, and we like the idea that there's something hard and valuable to it. But really, if you get into things like MMT, modern monetary theory, basically the idea is that the Fed can just print money willy-nilly, and deficits actually mean nothing, because all of it is just, it's all just numbers on a computer balance sheet. There's no gold anywhere that if we spend more of, we'll run out of gold to make up the difference of our debt. Ultimately, the Fed can decide to print money indefinitely. And of course you have inflation, but that, even that inflation now has become an accounting trick, because if you think about it, we have a $19 trillion debt, right? They've pumped huge amounts of money into the economy with quantitative easing, but we don't have inflation. How is that possible?
I don't know. How is it possible that the market is going up? When you put out your news, Vandal, every day, do you put out what you think is the most important story in the top, or are they all important to you?
Well, the first story to me is the tone setter. It's generally something that is going to set the tone for the beginning of the news, Vandal. The way I write, I put the news Vandal together, is I want it so that if you only read the headlines in order, you could get an idea of what's happening in the news cycle. I call it a meta story. I actually put the headlines so that if you read them in order, it's almost like a story unto itself.
Well, I'm surprised that the top story was about ISIS today.
Well, the top story was about CIA torture.
Oh.
That's what the story was.
I misread it then.
Yeah, no, that story was about Abu Zadaya and the psychiatrist in the CIA, the CIA's leading psychologist, who came up with the torture regime and how he has gotten away with doing it. I think the title had impunity in the title, and it's about the impunity with which he was able to, as a torturer who was hired by the CIA, to torture somebody to death and get away with it. Ghul Rahman is the guy who died. He died in a mostly naked, chained in a freezing cell in a underground bunker. And there has been no accountability for that. And I thought, since we were going to have a lot on the CIA today, it was a story that came out last night on Baffler. Baffler is a great source. And I also thought that sort of set the tone for what was going to be a very CIA-heavy rundown, which it was because of this CIA Trump hacking, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. And you know, during the 30s and 40s, people used to wonder, how could Germany, the most cultured nation in Europe, do what it is that they did with these intellectual giants performing these horrid deeds? But it wasn't such a question of Germans. It's a question of humanity, for crying out loud. We have Americans doing the same thing, maybe even worse on a bigger scale.
Well, look, genocide is something that's been around for a long time, and I think obviously the thing about Nazi Germany and having studied Nazi Germany and written about fascism as a graduate student in history, you know, the thing that gets people about Nazi Germany is the industrial scale of the Holocaust.
Exactly.
That's the thing. But it's not that I mean, I hate to get into, you know, equivalencies or whatnot, but the Holocaust of the Armenians under the Turks.
That's exactly right. Was
a genocide. And oh, by the way, we are, you know, I'm a member of the American Historical Association, and this is a debate that is going on inside academic history right now, is to what extent and how to define the American Indians' experience with the so-called winning of the West and just the colonization of the United States. And right now there is a big debate inside academic history as to the applicability of the term genocide. And I can tell you that the people who believe that genocide is an applicable term for what happened to the American Indian are winning, if there is such a thing. I mean, I hate to say use the term winning, but that definition is starting to become the canon. And genocides are things that have happened actually throughout history. And oh, by the way, we're now learning more and more about Neanderthals, and Neanderthals disappeared, 50,000 years ago. And we're trying to figure out how much Neanderthal there is in human beings. But what we are beginning to find is that the Neanderthals were actually wiped out by our Homo sapien ancestors. And it was actually a genocide. It was a process of rape, genocide, and actually some cannibalism that caused the Neanderthal to go away. So if you wonder if genocide is actually something that's deeply ingrained in the human consciousness.
Well, that's because Homo sapiens did not have a Neanderthal brain. They had a lizard brain. Anyway, Joe, thank you again so much. God, you're so interesting. Right after this show, where are you going to be?
I will be on Ground Zero with Clyde Lewis. If you type in Ground Zero, it should come up. It's on stations around the country. I know you can listen online. I don't know all the name of. I don't have all the affiliates. The main station is out of Portland, Oregon.
The host name is Clyde.
Clyde Lewis. Yep.
I must tell folks, Joe got me on Ground Zero a month ago to talk about the documentary, The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. I must tell you, Clyde Lewis was the best guy, aside from George Knapp, that I've ever talked to as a host on a show. And then, of course, Len O'Sonic is up there with that, too. Anyway, Joe, thank you. Thank you again. Where can folks get your News Vandal?
Just go to info@newsvandal.com and email me, and I'll send it to you. Or you can just go to newsvandal.com, and a little box will pop up, and you can sign up. So info@newsvandal.com, or just go to newsvandal.com. You can sign up either way. And John, as ever, my pleasure to be on with you. Another great show. And oh, by the way, folks, the film is coming. Just relax, it's coming.
Hey, thanks, Joe. thank you all, and I'd like to thank Mike Kim, Doug Newsom, our engineer, and all of you. As Ed Murray used to say, good night, good luck, happy holidays, and a Merry Christmas. I'll talk to you the day after Christmas. Bye bye.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.